I'm so happy to be in Canada. Okay, so today I'm going to talk to you guys about learning about neutrinos and dark radiation from cosmic data sets. And I will step back and tell you why I want to do this and then what we're going to do more specifically. So first off, what is the motivation? We're super familiar with this matter budget pie chart where everything that's worth dividing up into different categories and complexity lies in this little bitty area of atoms and some little sliver of photons, but like where the atoms are, what they're made of, you know, everything. And then we have these gigantic unknowns over here. And one can ask whether this is it in terms of whether these giant unknowns really is just like one giant percent of something like cold dark matter, or whether there's more complexity. So is the pie chart really so simple? And let's look. So this is our pie chart, and it's missing. There's this tiny little sliver here, which is mostly neutrinos, which today are like something like less than 0.1% of the energy density, and then photons, which are down another order of magnitude. And one could have, we know we have at least, you know, two types of dark matter. We have something very cold, and then we have neutrinos, which are warm and hot. And one could have more stuff in there. And this looks maybe unimpressive to think about looking for tiny fractional contributions to the energy budget today. But it helps to look at the pie chart in the past. And this is the pie chart of what we expect. So here's what we have today. Here's what we know from CMB decoupling, or the epoch of CMB decoupling, where neutrinos and photons constitute a much larger fraction of the energy budget. And then going deeper into the radiation-dominated era, things are just all neutrinos and photons. Going to even higher temperatures, there's, you know, can expand this pie chart and see leptons and all the other gauge bosons come into thermal equilibrium. And we have these much more complicated pie charts at earlier epochs. And this is what we expect from the standard model. But we also can test for other things. So an example of what could be is some other light particle that is important in the early universe, important at a low level. Current constraints constrain things to be something like 5% of the radiation density at early times, and therefore decreasing at late times. These new light particles could still have some mass, which makes their energy density comparable to the neutrino energy density today. So that is what could be. And the interesting thing is that current data allows this, and future data will test things at a much more precise level. So that's something we should go for. And then, of course, neutrinos are in the standard model, but their mass is not in the standard model. Maybe they have some other weird stuff related to, you know, leptogenesis or whatever. But neutrinos still have unknowns, and in cosmology, we have the most neutrinos of any other scenario. They're the second most abundant particles in the universe. So let's do everything we can to study them. So that's my motivation. And then the outline of my talk is as follows. I'm going to talk about light relics. I'm going to talk about adding interactions among light relics, and then some effects on observables. And then I will conclude. OK, so here's a timeline of the universe and the temperature, which roughly scales as 1 over A, with changes to that as different species come in and out of equilibrium. And here we are today with a photon temperature of 10 to the minus 4 EV. But we know if we go back in time, things change. So when we reach temperatures of order the rest mass of electrons and positrons, those pairs are produced and come into equilibrium. As we go to temperatures of MeV, neutrinos are in equilibrium with everything else. They're not produced at this point, but they're scattering and in thermal equilibrium with the standard model. And when you reach temperatures of order 100 GeV, all standard model particles are in equilibrium. So the point of this diagram is to remind you that as you go to higher temperatures, more and more particles are important, right? Suppose we didn't know about all these standard model particles. Well, we know, one could imagine you could learn that they're present because they contribute at early times to the energy budget of the universe somehow. So a question is, if I have any other light particle that has coupling to the standard model, sufficient coupling that it can come into equilibrium, then it too would be produced and present in the early universe. And we don't know, we have bounds on, you know, it, something is not, there's no new light particle that's coupled to the standard model at, and in equilibrium at times when the CMB decouples, but it could happen at early times. And this arrow roughly illustrates the range of temperatures at which something could be, where the current data constrains things. So roughly what we know is that below 100 MeV, if there was new light particles that came into complete thermal equilibrium with the standard model and therefore had large abundances comparable to the abundance of other bosons and fermions, then they would contribute a lot to the radiation density, and those are ruled out. Yet if they were in equilibrium at temperatures above this, their energy density will be smaller today, and they wouldn't be there. So so that I will say more about these constraints in a moment, but that's the idea. We have this whole range of things that we can learn about, and the future cosmic microwave background data with large scale structure is actually able to probe the existence of any light particles coupled to the standard model in equilibrium, not quite at arbitrarily high temperatures for like a single degree of freedom, but we are approaching being able to constrain the existence of anything that was ever in thermal equilibrium. Also, please ask questions during my talk. That makes it more fun. If you have them, feel free to interrupt. I'm happy to hear questions. Okay, so if we have some timeline and some expectations about particles that come into equilibrium, then this gives a prediction for the history of, say, photon and neutrino temperatures. So here's a diagram showing just the last early, I guess, since temperatures of MeV until today, evolution of the photon temperature and neutrino temperatures. So at super high temperatures and early times, neutrinos are in equilibrium with photons and they have a common temperature. That temperature sets all the things we know about them, like their energy density and their number density, because it's thermal, that's the only number you need. At later times, neutrino temperature, all the momenta are just redshifting like 1 over a, so the neutrino temperature just redshifts like 1 over a, and nothing happens to it, assuming that they don't do anything else exotic. Whereas the photons, their temperature their momenta are all redshifting like 1 over a, and their temperature is decreasing. Yet at some point when electrons and positrons annihilate, that injects a bunch of energy back into the photons and heats the photons relative to the neutrinos, so the photon temperature decreases more slowly until later. Every time there's a transition in the number of degrees of freedom that interact with the rest of the standard model, then some particle decouples, the photons and all the other standard model particles they're coupled to, their temperature will increase by this factor of GS to the 1/3. And then after that, it decreases like 1 over a cubed. Okay, so the summary is that if you know these transitions and the number of degrees of freedom at earlier and earlier times, you can predict the relative temperatures of all of different species according to when they decouple. So we know neutrinos decoupled prior to E plus E minus annihilation, and therefore their temperature is smaller than the photon temperature by a known amount of 4/11 to the 1/3, roughly. Okay, but then given our knowledge of these temperatures, we then know the energy density and the number density just from integrating the Fermi-Dirac distribution. And so we have predictions for the phase space distribution function for neutrinos, for instance. So here's the photon thermal spectrum measured by COBE and COBE-FIRAS. And then that gives a prediction for the neutrino spectrum with a temperature of like 1.95 Kelvin. So this is a great thing about neutrinos that we look for. But you can also do this exact same exercise with any other new light particles. And the idea is that depending on when these particles decouple, you will know how much lower their temperature is than photon and neutrino temperatures. But after they decouple, if they're thermal, all that one number, the temperature, is all you need to know to specify, again, their number density and their energy density and their full distribution. Okay. So this is more commonly referred to as the ineffective parameter, which is a measure of the radiation, the total radiation density minus the photon contribution, which we measure directly, divided by the photon contribution, which with these factors that make ineffective, so ineffective is a measure of the contribution to the radiation density in units of the predicted neutrino contribution for neutrinos that decouple instantaneously. And that's where this is this fermion factor of 7/8, and then the temperature of neutrinos being suppressed to photons gives this factor here. So standard model prediction for neutrinos, ineffective is not exactly 3 because the temperature of neutrinos relative to photons is not exactly 4/11 to the 1/3. It's a little bit larger than that because neutrinos are not completely decoupled during E plus E minus annihilation. And other interesting processes make changes to this like third digit here. But that's the standard model prediction. But the argument is that any other light degrees of freedom will still contribute to the rate that are present can contribute to the radiation budget. And so we can go out and look for it. And one can relate if you have some species that you know its spin degrees of freedom and the temperature that it freezes out at, you can predict the contribution to the radiation density in these units of ineffective. So conversely, if you measure this parameter, delta ineffective, or put constraints on it, you're putting constraints on the thermal history of the universe at temperatures described by these lines. So these lines indicate vector and Weyl fermion, the relationship between the freeze-out temperature and the contribution to delta ineffective. And these basically, as you go to these lines here, asymptote to the minimal prediction for something that was in thermal equilibrium with the standard model above the temperature at which all the standard model particles decoupled. And so our goal with future, so this also shows the current Planck constraints, which limit things that this plot actually doesn't go all the way down to show the connection between the freeze-out temperature, but it's things can be in thermal equilibrium. We're not yet going past the QCD phase transition, which is this big. Is that the QCD phase transition? This one? Yeah. Oh, sorry. It is. Okay. Here. But with future experiments, in particular CMBS4, which I'm quite involved with in this light relics constraints, we hope to get constraints on ineffective, such that we're probing eras beyond the QCD phase transition and once all of the standard model particles are in equilibrium. So that represents like a quantum change and a qualitative shift in what we know about the early universe. Yeah.
Are there models where there's not another light particle, but you have some mechanism that heats up the neutrinos and that's the way that ineffective changes?
Yes. I don't know. I don't have a concrete example in mind. Somebody else might in the audience, but.
Questions. So here, when you discuss sensitivity, in the past, you assume that there is an injection from standard model only, right?
That's right. Yeah. Good. So what I like about this is that it's not shown on, I didn't show it on this plot, but just to clarify, so the minimal contribution to ineffective from any other light particle ever, assuming standard model only, is delta ineffective of 0.027, which is a single scalar degree of freedom that decoupled decoupled above 100 GeV. Of course, if you do something like add supersymmetry where you double all the particles, then that minimal contribution will go down, but it goes down by a ratio of the G star factors to the 1/3. So it's not super crazy sensitive to if you add new degrees of freedom, you change the shapes of these curves, but in a way that if you double the degrees of freedom, you don't get a gigantic change in this factor.
Any coupling also to dark sector?
Yeah, so here this is this firm prediction for a single thing that is in thermal equilibrium and then freezes out. But if you have that thing doing something else or heating something else or getting heating, you could totally change
it.
What's that? Yeah, you're assuming, that the universe is thermal at 100 GeV to get there. If you change, you're assuming that you have radiation-dominated thermal population of the standard model. So if you really load the reheat temperature, then I don't know. I actually
people try, what happens if, experimentally, they're all bound to the TD heat.
I think it's like 8 MeV or something, but I don't think then the minimal contribution is, I would think it would be larger, because the statement is if something was ever in equilibrium with a standard model, so then it would be in equilibrium at like 8 MeV, right? Or it would never reach equilibrium at all.
Yeah.
So if it, why?
Because if it's something that's supposed to be, the standard model never heats, you never produce the particle, right?
Yeah, exactly.
If it has to decouple at 100 GeV,
if it's never thermally produced, then you don't get any change. But if it's thermally produced ever, then the change is larger for later for thermal production at a later temperature.
No, I just wanted to understand how many variables there are.
If the calculation is the simple one where you just need to know the degrees of freedom that are in equilibrium, and you're working backwards in some sense. So at some point, my interpretation of the question you're asking is just a statement that I draw these lines backwards, and I never actually reach thermal equilibrium, so that other particle just isn't produced, and then definitely, it doesn't contribute. So it has to be strong. It has to be coupled at some point, but it doesn't depend on the actual, like, the statement is just that it's thermal, not that it depends on the coupling to the extent that it was sufficiently coupled to come into equilibrium. I'll give an example of you'll see with the interactions how this can be changed. For instance, some freeze-in or something like that. Okay, so this is something that we measure, and the main ways of measuring this are from cosmic microwave background, and there's this nice sort of classic paper here that illustrates how adding extra relativistic degrees of freedom, which changes the total energy density at early times, therefore primarily affects the damping scale. There are degeneracies that with matter radiation equality and changing the sound horizon and so on. But the primary way in which we extract information about light relics from the CMB is from the ratio of this damping scale to the distance to last scattering. So that's the L-dependent decay here can be thought of as measuring those two ratios. And the current constraints from Planck are great. They are in excellent agreement with what we expect from three standard model neutrinos. And what we hope to do in 10-ish years is to improve these by a large amount. Okay. One point is that everything I was just talking about having some new light stuff that is relativistic, and so it contributes to the radiation budget. But the composition of that relativistic stuff is also important for observables. So the damping scale just depends on Hubble, which is the total energy density in relativistic particles. But these relativistic particles will have perturbations, from inflation or whatever, along with everything else. And the behavior of those perturbations depends on the composition of the stuff. So the standard picture of constraining ineffective refers to looking at things that are like neutrinos. And neutrinos have been neutrinos decoupled from interactions with the standard model and with themselves at MeV temperatures, and are therefore completely free streaming for all of the epochs that we can measure with current data. And so that leads to a specific effect on perturbations, which is nicely illustrated by this animation, which is this animation is usually used for the BAO, but what I want to draw your attention to is the fact that this shows dark matter, baryons, and then photons and neutrinos. And what you should look at is the difference between photons and neutrinos perturbations on this plot. And you see that the photons are tightly coupled to the baryons, and they have this narrow peak, whereas the neutrinos have a big spread in their propagation. And that's related to the fact that neutrinos, the neutrino perturbations have a larger velocity of dispersion. Neutrinos propagate at C, and the photon baryon fluid perturbations propagate at the median of both of them is the same, but the neutrinos propagate further. As the photons do once they're decoupled. And that difference in propagation gives a slight difference in like the sound horizon that enters into the calculation of the CMB and large-scale structure peaks. And that difference in propagation leads to a phase shift. So the neutrino perturbations begin to evolve earlier than tightly coupled photon perturbations. And so that pulls the peak of the CMB to a slightly larger scale or lower L. And that phase shift is what is visible on these nice plots from Ben Wallisch's thesis, which illustrate that even if you keep all of these other parameters fixed, like fixing matter radiation equality and the damping scale, there's still a residual shift in the features of the power spectrum just from this free streaming radiation. okay, but that's interesting. So what we have some idea that we might be able to detect some contribution to the relativistic energy density, but we want to learn more about it because there's a lot of things that it could be. All we get are these gravitational signatures of something that has energy density that goes like 1 over a cubed, but it could be much more than that. I mean, there's the thing that we can look at is looking for interactions which modify the perturbations in this stuff. So this is some work done with, Jay has moved. This is a former postdoc of mine, Tice Brinkman, who's now faculty at University of Ferrara. And then Jay Hook Chang, who's actually now moved to Fermilab. I forgot to change that. And Peiji Du, who's a postdoc at Rutgers. So these postdocs got excited about these ideas, and we wrote some papers on it. So the idea is that suppose we have some contribution to the energy budget that we measure. We have no idea what it is, and there's a lot of idea. In principle, it could be gravitational waves, which are relativistic particles. It could be some weird beyond the standard model stuff. It could be thermal axions. It could be a stereoneutrino, the original thing people talked about. It could be whatever. And so we have this very blunt probe with which to learn about stuff in the early universe. And then the statement is that we can learn more about the energy density by studying the gravitational dynamics of perturbations. So here's a cartoon of this showing a blob of neutrinos that are free streaming. So they just pass through each other and everything without scattering. And that's true for standard model neutrinos after a redshift of a billion. And roughly speaking, their perturbations propagate at C. While photons are tightly coupled to baryons and behave as a single relativistic fluid, and the perturbations of the relativistic fluid propagate at a reduced sound speed. Technically, the neutrino sound speed of dp d rho is also 1 over square root 3, but as you saw, because the pressure perturbations, the neutrino perturbations are not just characterized by energy density and pressure, because they're not a perfect fluid. You have all of these higher order moments, and the presence of those higher order moments allows some spread in their propagation. Oops, I showed that plot already. Okay, so the presence of any additional interactions or the absence of them is important for observables. And interactions in general could depend on time or temperature. And if we want to model some additional contribution to the relativistic energy density, we need to know the interaction history to do this completely. So here's an example of that. So what's plotted here is an estimate of the scattering rate of some particles. And in these cases, in all of these examples, the particles could be scattering off themselves or something else. So what's shown is the scattering rate as a function of temperature. So this depends on some thermal population of these particles, and then how the scattering rate itself depends on the center of mass energy. So if I have some self-interactions of particles like neutrinos or something that are mediated by a heavy mediator, then the scattering rate scales as t to the fifth, which is a much stronger decrease. Whereas if I have self-interactions that are mediated by a light, this is a typo. This should say t right here. That's a big mistake. I should fix that. The self-interactions mediated by a light mediator scale as t.
Sorry, what is t?
Temperature.
What should say t?
This says t to the fifth. And that's because I LaTeX copied and pasted this to like save time looking up symbols. Yeah, it should be lambda squared t, not to the fifth. Whereas if I have something like dark photons interacting with dark atoms, I have a stronger suppression in scattering as I go to low temperatures. Because, for instance, the dark atoms form, if the dark atoms have some binding energy and the temperature drops below that binding energy, then you just lose all the free electrons there. And so I have some different temperature dependence. I'm really sorry about that light mediator typo. And then to understand what the interaction history is in cosmology, you compare the scattering rates to the Hubble rate, which goes like t squared. And the temperature is decreasing with time. And so what you see is for these examples, like there's some overall arbitrary normalization that depends on the interaction rates, but the temperature dependence is the important thing. And what you see is that these cases where the interaction rate is large compared to the Hubble rate at high temperatures means that those interactions are in equilibrium early on and then drop below the Hubble rate. And so those interactions cease to be in equilibrium. Whereas this recoupling, this light mediator case, the interaction rate is smaller than Hubble at early times. So it's not in equilibrium. And then at later times, the interaction rate exceeds Hubble because it decreases with temperature more slowly. So all of these are just like three classes of examples of things that can happen. And one way of characterizing what these do is in terms of the opacity of the universe for these new particles. So this could be neutrinos or it could be any other new particles. And what's illustrated here is like a cartoon of examples of the opacity for these three sort of qualitatively distinct cases that all have a transition at some finite time. And I have two cases where things start out in equilibrium, meaning the universe is very opaque to these particles, and then they decouple. But the duration of that decoupling is pretty different depending on whether they decouple via a heavy mediator or because there's some threshold of a new state like the like dark atoms. And of course, this is completely opposite to the case of something that initially the interaction is not in equilibrium at all, so the universe is transparent for those particles, and then the interaction increases very, very slowly, and eventually the universe becomes completely opaque. Questions? Okay, so checking back in, if you got bored for a minute, a quick summary of that is that if I have time-dependent changes to the evolution of stuff, such as time-dependent changes to the opacity, that's going to lead to time-dependent changes in the evolution of the metric perturbations that go into computing CMB and LSS. Yet these observables are primarily sensitive to metric perturbations at some scale. Each physical scale in these observables is sensitive to metric perturbations at some range of times. And so these time-dependent changes here will give scale-dependent changes in the observables. And so the claim will be that these time-dependent, these different properties of stuff that can contribute to radiation density in the early universe will lead to distinct signatures in data. And so we can generalize our an effective parameter to be things that are free streaming, which includes standard model neutrinos, it includes gravitational waves, and perhaps other examples as well. You can have something that behaves like a fluid, meaning it stays tightly coupled for the whole history of the observable radiation-dominated era, which counts as being tightly coupled till about redshift of 2000. And that could be anything with really strong interactions, such as self-interactions or dark photons scattering off dark atoms. And then you could have something that's a mix of these, which we call an interacting here, which would be something that transitions between tightly coupled and free streaming. And it could go either way. It could recouple or it could decouple, and the transition rate could depend on things. But we can separately look at each of these properties in data.
Yeah. It's like the radiation factors themselves.
It's not exactly. It doesn't interact with this. So for instance, for these neutrino examples, it would be that the neutrinos decouple from the standard model, but they continue to scatter off themselves until late times.
But also, like, they don't interact with dark matter.
Yeah, it could be that, like, this idea of, like, dark atoms or dark photons decoupling from dark atoms, that would be, the dark atoms would be some part of dark matter. So if you want to constrain that case, then you have to limit the dark atom content. But if you have anything close to our photon to baryon ratio, it's not hard to do that. And I mean, sorry, if our photon to baryon ratio is so high that if the dark sector has anything close to that, then you can have, you know, 5% of the radiation density in the early universe is dark photons, and the contribution from dark atoms is just really tiny compared to that. But you can separate, like Francis Yan has these papers separately constraining that. Okay, so here's a cartoon of how this looks. This is the time dependence of the perturbation and the radiation density plotted as a function of k tau. So k tau of order 1 is horizon crossing. And then there's a bunch of different examples of different types of dark radiation. So something that is purely fluid-like is this yellow curve. So k tau is of order 1. We cross the horizon. This thing gets a kick, and it undergoes acoustic oscillations with a large amplitude after that. And these cases where I have some effective coupling constant, which is large, will also undergo acoustic oscillations after a horizon crossing. Whereas something that is free streaming is this gray one. And the free streaming perturbations have a slight shift in this peak of when they enter the horizon. And then the amplitude decays just without undergoing these oscillations. And something that these examples here are something that's decoupling via a heavy mediator. And I picked examples where the interaction strength is large, so it stays tightly coupled for a long time, and then it would look just like a fluid, as well as cases where the interaction strength is really weak and decouples earlier or decouples right around horizon crossing. So obviously there's two regimes. There's the case where something is so weakly coupled, you know, it approaches neutrinos and it looks just like the free streaming thing. It's so tightly coupled, it looks like fluid. And then for each Fourier mode at some time, there could be something that has an interaction strength that decouples around the time of horizon crossing. And that's this third case where you get some different behavior. So here's some plot illustrating how this composition difference shows up in CMB data. So these are plots of the E-mode power spectrum that I picked just because I really like the sharp peaks make things a little easier to look at. But it's also in TT and TE. And on each plot has a black curve, which is identical, which is standard model neutrinos with these black peaks. And then on each plot, on this plot, the blue curve is adding a unit delta n effective of 1, and red is adding delta n effective of 2. And that's the same over here. But the difference between the left and right plots is that on the left plot, the new part species that I add to the radiation density are completely fluid-like. And on the right plot, they're free-streaming like neutrinos. And so you see some pretty visible, even though the total radiation budget is the same, and so matter radiation equality is the same, and the damping scale is the same, the CMB spectra look really different. And these differences are due to the behavior of the perturbations. So the most striking difference is probably the amplitudes of these peaks here. That turns out to be pretty degenerate with other cosmological parameters. And the thing that is harder to see here is this phase shift, which is distinct. This plot illustrates the same thing. So these are power spectra with a common total radiation density. And then I have pure fluid and pure neutrino. And then the black curves are going to animate something that decouples at some finite time. So if the decoupling is above a redshift of about 100,000, then in the CMB peaks that we see, it looks identical to neutrinos. Whereas if the decoupling is below about 2,000, then it looks identical to fluid, and somewhere in between, it looks somewhere in between. Okay, so the point that I want to make is that the process of this decoupling is visible in CMB power spectra. This just plots the fractional change. And the scale dependence of that depends on when the interactions transition from being tightly coupled to free streaming. And there's a special scale, which is around the value of the horizon, which is the K mode that corresponds to the mode crossing the horizon around the time of decoupling, will imprint at a specific L on the CMB. And it's a little more visible in EE, which is why I plotted that. Another thing that is interesting is that the duration of the transition of decoupling is also visible. So something that decouples instantaneously will have a sharper transition than something that decouples more slowly.
Can I ask, so in this plot, what are you assuming for the initial abundance?
I think these plots are delta N effective of 0.5 for each. Each of these, this is a fractional difference between the EE power spectrum, between a case that has, these are cases where in all the plots, I have an additional delta N effective of 0.5. And then the fractional difference is between when that thing is free streaming and when it has some fluid-like behavior. And if delta N effective is larger, you get common shapes, but a bigger difference.
So in the picture that you described in the beginning, when would these have decoupled?
If it's delta N effective of 0.5, I think it's below 100 MeV. Or it's many degrees of freedom at a higher temperature.
Oh.
For these purposes, I'm just plotting the total contribution to the radiation density, which you could, if you know the spin, you could and the number.
If you have many degrees of freedom.
So this picture?
Yeah. Because your density in each sector is different.
Yeah, in this case, the statement, so the way that where these curves come from is, again, I apologize about this t to the fifth, but the T squared here is from the interaction, and then T cubed is from the abundance of that stuff. So it could be that the temperature is smaller, but the scaling with, so this is scaling with temperature, which becomes time dependent since temperature goes like 1/A. So the scaling with temperature remains the same, but the value of the temperature just is the thing that changes, if I understand your question correctly.
The temperature will change, I don't know what the temperature.
I think you should think of it as a scaling that.
What do you mean?
Just like the temperature is an overall normalization.
Yeah, I mean like.
Yeah, but the density is lower, right? So
but the, many, I think.
So the point is, if you have 1 degree of freedom.
Yeah.
Couple at 100 MeV, and G effective is like 1/MeV, then the mediator will.
Yeah, you have to be careful.
So then I want to understand what consistent cosmological history is this scenario that has.
Yeah, it's a good question. So let me just say one thing to make sure I understand. So all I was trying to say is that the number density goes like the temperature of the stuff cubed. So, and if this is, you know, if Tx over T gamma is some parameter, then this just, it's still, the time depend, like that, that rescales the overall amplitude of this curve, but doesn't change the shape.
Yeah. It's
but
just, you made the comment about many degrees of freedom decoupling earlier. I would imagine then that you would assume that you have many sectors whose C is really small. That's another thing.
Yeah.
If you had 1 degree of freedom, the thing that I'm concerned about in the plot you were showing is that if they were decoupled at 100 MeV, then the mediator, which is one of their 100 MeV at the heaviest, will also be in thermal equilibrium. So then you have more degrees of freedom that have not been accounted for properly. But if you have many sectors that have small amounts, that's a different scenario.
Yes, I might have some pauses, but let's say that the mediator is, yeah, like 100 MeV or something, this decoupling, yeah, okay. I have a plot later that shows an example of a relationship between mediator mass and coupling, where there's lines of what time, when the decoupling happens at.
Okay.
But I guess, the statement, in that case, I think it's correct that the decoupling is still gonna, the decoupling is happening at a temperature lower than the mediator mass.
Oh, of the interactions.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that I agree with. I'm asking about the cosmology of.
Yeah, but okay,
of
but
if the
mediator has a mass of 100 MeV, it's not contributing to N effective because it's non-relativistic.
No, but it will be in thermal equilibrium. If the particle is in thermal equilibrium at 100 MeV,
yeah,
the mediator will be in thermal equilibrium.
It will, but the abundance will be tiny. Because it's non-relativistic, so
you will have some abundance, and then it will do other stuff. It depends. And 100 MeV is the smallest of the couplings that you showed. In fact, most of the mediators you had were MeV.
Yeah.
So for those, they would be relativistic. So you have another relativistic.
But sorry, I think just to make sure I understand. I think I forgot to say one really key thing is that there's this firm prediction for the contribution to delta N effective depending on when it decoupled. But in order for us to see it as a contribution of the radiation density, the particle itself has to have a mass that's less than about an EV.
Yeah, but the mediator will decay to these guys. If it's a heavy mediator and these are light, the mediator will never be. It will eventually become radiation again.
Yeah, I know that this happens with the light mediator. This can happen with instances of the light mediator. Like in our paper with Jay and Peiji, we specifically consider a light mediator mediating interactions between a scalar through a 5/4. But if you have a light mediator interacting with something like these fermions, then we did worry about this reverse interaction. But for the heavy mediator, I didn't think that was...
I'm worried about the pollen. So you have...
But the heavy mediator should decay into other particles at a high temperature, right? Like of order its mass.
We contribute, so at the time.
I'm talking about entropy down at the same time, right?
Yeah, I'm talking about the entropy down to that sector.
Right, but like that sector is always colder, right? Like it's just like a rescaling.
No, the 0.5 I'm arguing about, if you have two particles, right? There's the fermion that interacts with the mediator. And it looks like I want to understand what is counted in the N effective. Because if there are mediators at an MeV, and the decoupling happens at 100 MeV, the mediator will definitely be in thermal equilibrium in terms of mass. So the degrees of freedom in the...
But that won't show up, I mean, the only things we see as relativistic are stuff that's relativistic at CMV.
Because it's heavy. So then there's going to be whatever prediction for N effective you got from just decoupling. That's why I'm asking about consistent cosmological.
Yeah, but why does, I guess I just don't, we should maybe talk about this later, but I would have thought that a mediator, yeah, I guess I'm interested in an example where you have a heavy mediator that acquires some relic abundance,
mm-hmm.
that then acquires some relic abundance and decouples.
Yeah.
I may have a wrong picture, like electron, positron, and photon.
Yeah, those heat the photons when the temperature drops below the rest mass and they're no longer pair produced. So at temperatures well below the rest mass of electrons and positrons, we just don't have an abundance of electrons and positrons. They're all gone.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I think that was simple. So if you like, let me try to.
Okay.
Translate.
But we might have like this is let's let this in shed light on
what Mina's saying is like the abundance you get in the end of the radiation depends on like the mediator being like a coupled or not, like at earlier time. So if the mediator is coupled, then like the effective you get is not like the number of really light degree of freedom times the number you get like from the plot when they decouple, but like also from like this mediator contribution of like the entropy down contribution to this number, right?
Yeah, I guess I'm just
bigger, so like maybe like 0.5 is not something that you can.
Sorry, but I guess to understand what the entropy dump from the mediator comes when the temperature of that sector is of order the rest mass of the mediator,
yes.
Whereas the coupling decoupling thing has this extra parameter here, which depends on the mass of that, but depends on, I mean, is it the same?
I
thought the sequence was that the thermal decoupling of the mediator should happen earlier, and the entropy dump of the mediator becoming non-relativistic would happen prior to. This interaction is only the right thing to write down if the temperature is small compared to the mediator mass.
Yeah. I think she agreed with you on that.
Yeah. Oh, I have no doubt. but then I'm confused about the statement that.
What is the consistent cosmological system?
It's more about like I think that GX you wrote there is a function of type 2. But anyway, like.
That should be that. Time dependence would change. It doesn't enter this plot, and it doesn't.
About consistent cosmological history, because when someone writes a mediator that's an MEV, that's pretty light cosmologically.
But not at the time, not at the any of the epochs that we really measure.
We measure BBN.
Yeah, but that's way below an MEV. That's way below.
This effect you're talking about now happens much later. I'm talking about if there is going to be a consistent cosmological prediction for the abundance of the dark sector.
Yeah, but I'm saying that maybe there is a medium.
Because G-effective is one of G-effective.
Is it what we need?
Yeah. Right. Look at the number.
It's huge it's huge for these examples that I'm plotting where you see some time dependence. But BBN is good. So these decouple, in order for us to see anything in CMB, this interaction strength has to be small. This interaction transition has to be way after BBN, but that also means that the thing is totally non-relativistic by that point. So it has to have, there has to be some. Yeah, it seems like to dump a bunch of energy into radiation, I need that mediator to freeze out with a large relic abundance somehow that then decays into something else, and that gives these steps to ineffective. But if it doesn't freeze out with a large relic abundance, if it just annihilates into these other particles, that will have happened at earlier time. But not, yeah.
Yeah, it's okay.
No,
yes.
I got it. Yes.
No, carry on. We can stop. Because now we are just, I think we've exhausted the talk. I think we can discuss it offline.
But I think I just don't understand how this scenario happens, that something is, it has a large relic abundance and it's totally non-relativistic. But then you're saying it.
I think that's what she's saying.
No.
Oh. Just like a, yeah.
Let's talk about it later.
You're talking about two different things.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's carry on.
Okay. Okay, you also get signatures in large scale structure, not just CMB. And one interesting thing that happens is you get these like features in large scale structure. So first of all, the only time the only way you learn anything, the only time any of these interactions are relevant is during the radiation-dominated era, because you're always seeing gravitational stuff. And so you need something to be a significant contributor to the energy density in order to see any effect. But dark matter gets some interaction, has the evolution of dark matter perturbations depends on what the dark radiation is doing. Dark radiation has this behavior, like these acoustic oscillations, and also this decay. The better way to understand what the dark matter is going to see is to time average these perturbations to the radiation density. And so that's what's plotted here, is a time average of this. And that's because something that's these acoustic oscillations have a large amplitude in perturbations, but time averaged over an oscillation, their contribution to the gravitational potential is zero. So they end up sourcing weaker potentials that have seed fluctuations of CDM than something that is free streaming and appears to have a smaller perturbation to the energy density, but time averaged over these oscillations ends up sourcing a larger gravitational potential. So this plot shows time average of these perturbations. And on this plot, you see around horizon crossing, things that are still fluid-like are interacting, have a larger amplitude. But later, the free streaming stuff has a larger amplitude. And that leads to that same signature in the evolution of dark matter perturbations. So this shows the fractional difference in the evolution of a dark matter perturbation for different wave numbers for something that has a fixed decoupling transition around here. And something that is a small wave number, so it enters the horizon while everything is completely fluid-like, has a little bump around horizon crossing, but then has a suppressed amplitude later. Whereas something that enters the horizon well after decoupling, when it's free streaming, has a larger amplitude. And then these modes that enter right around the decoupling time get a little bit of a kick. So this leads to scale-dependent changes in the matter power spectrum, where at low k, things look the same as free streaming, because these are modes that enter the horizon during the matter-dominated era. It doesn't matter. At super high k, something that all of these modes enter during the radiation-dominated era, and if the stuff is fluid-like when it enters, the power spectrum is suppressed relative to the free streaming case. And for modes that enter the horizon right around the time of transition, you get this peak feature because they get an enhancement from entering, from being fluid-like at horizon entry, but then they just decouple and decay following the free streaming case and end up sourcing a slightly larger potential. And even for something that never transitions between fluid-like and free streaming, you see the same thing. You also see a bump around the matter radiation equality scale because the potentials get a boost relative to the free streaming scale, and then radiation perturbations are less important. Okay, so you get changes to the matter power spectrum, and they care about when the interaction happened and the duration of the transition. So here's something that decouples more slowly from self-interactions. This is this instantaneous decoupling that would be like dark photons from dark atoms, and this is the recoupling case. So at super high k in the radiation-dominated era, the thing is not tightly coupled, and then the interactions come into equilibrium, and I get some suppression depending on when they come into equilibrium, but it's a slower transition from that temperature scaling. We and many other people now have looked for this in CMB data, and the first thing you can do that's been done going back like a decade by Francis Yan and other people is to just look at CMB data and ask about neutrino interactions. And something kind of interesting happens if you look at this combination, for instance, of CMB data from Planck, and you try to jointly constrain the interaction strength, which can be written in terms of a decoupling time, and the number of degrees of freedom, you see two modes in the data. There's a mode where you have the normal amount of N-effective, three neutrinos, and all you know is that you have a lower bound on the redshift at which something decoupled. So this mode This shows that the data is basically not sensitive to something that decouples before a redshift of 100,000. So this is continuously connected to standard model neutrinos. We just can't get there. But there is the second mode that appears in the data where you have a slightly different number of degrees of freedom and then neutrinos that stay strongly tightly coupled to themselves for a long time. We find that the second mode completely disappears when you add H-naught data. So it's not a solution to the Hubble tension, but it's just a separate.
So which H-naught data do
you add? Shoes. Okay. I mean, sorry, these constraints do not include H-naught data. Uh-huh. This is just a statement because everyone wants to know about the Hubble tension. And
but,
if you.
But H-naught is in conflict with everything outside of itself.
Yeah. because somebody is gonna, you know, okay, I'm really proud of you all that nobody asked about the, about adding H-naught data right now. But what, no, sorry, I didn't mean that at all. It's very important. It's a very important open problem in observational cosmology. No, it is. I mean, and you have to ask, right? I mean, of course, there have also, there's another paper that finds the second mode and finds that it goes away when you add, if you add H-naught data, but you remove high L polarization, then the mode stays and they solves the H-naught tension, so it reduces the H-naught tension. So it depends a bit on the data set. But
so this is probably very strong indirection.
Yeah, yeah.
Ruled out?
Yeah, ruled out. Okay, this is ruled out by particle physics data, and I get mixed. And I've had some particle physicists tell me I shouldn't be so conservative that you can model build anything and allow it. So, but yeah. Okay, not you, but someone else. Someone else, because I'm always like, but you can't have it. It's incompatible. I mean, I'll show a plot in a second. That's interesting. One thing is that there actually have been, you know, as I mentioned, these interactions show up in the matter power spectrum. And last fall, there were two separate papers that came out that actually find the second mode in large-scale structure data. There was a paper like 2 days ago that I have not yet read by one of these same authors that actually says it's not compatible overall. But it's kind of an interesting piece of this puzzle of consistency. So there have been a few papers pointing out that these strongly self-interacting neutrino cases should be completely ruled out. And this is a plot from our paper where we just rewrite these constraints in terms of flavor eigenstate, sorry, in terms of mass eigenstates instead of flavor eigenstates. And what I want to show here is that this is some plane that's coupling strength and mediator mass. And these curves, these shaded regions show what is excluded by particle physics data depending on which states mediate the interaction. So if all three mass eigenstates are interacting, then the constraints are much stronger. And if only one is, then the constraints are weaker. But from the cosmology perspective, what's also shown on this plot is these lines showing, along these lines, the decoupling time would be a redshift of 10,000, whereas along this line, the decoupling time would be a redshift of a billion. And of course, standard model neutrinos are a redshift of 10 to the 9. So I just told you that CMB data is really only sensitive to things that decouple. Maybe after a redshift of a million, you get some tiny signatures. But the peak sensitivity in CMB data is something that decouples around 10 to the 4. And that's where these modes are detected. And that's like totally excluded here. And you also see that CMB and large-scale structure data, probably too, aren't really sensitive to, they're only really marginally sensitive to something that isn't already ruled out by particle physics within this implementation. So I certainly don't know the caveats that go into the model building to relate these, you know, constraints from K on decays, for instance, to these self-interactions, but it's interesting. It's an interesting exercise. Okay, and I don't want to bore you, but so that's, you can also look for, you can put general constraints on interaction, like not just an effective, like I showed before, but split an effective up into multiple components where I have a free streaming component and a self-interacting component, and then I study constraints on the self-interaction strength, and we don't find any evidence for anything new. If you allow interactions, you somewhat relax the constraints on the total energy density. And the CMB is sensitive to the transitions in the interactions, primarily sensitive to things that decouple around redshift of like 10,000. And of course, not sensitive to things that decouple too early or too late.
So you mean an abundance of relativistic?
Yeah.
When you talk about energy density.
Yeah.
Is that the range you can speak?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So for neutrinos, there was a second solution, but okay, it's ruled out. So now you have another rally. Is there a second solution as well? Do we have a?
Yeah. So I think there's two plots I'll show you that look at this. This one is one plot that it just jointly constrains two parameters. One is free streaming, and the other is interacting. And then here's the interaction acting. And then I can show you another set of plots here, which show joint, you fix neutrinos, and then you just look for additional delta N effective constraints. And we don't do the analysis of everything at once. We first look for additional stuff. So on every one of these plots, the free streaming, the constraints on delta N effective that's free streaming are red, and the constraints on delta N effective that's fluid-like are blue. And then on this one, we also we compare those to something that decouples instantaneously, and we have a joint constraint on the decoupling time. So you see, for instance, actually, this is a good one to look at. So this is the decoupling redshift, and this is the contribution to delta N effective. So if something decouples, actually, now I'm a little bit confused. If some the constraints on N effective depend on when something decoupled, and that's visible on all of these plots. Although, yeah, that's right. So here we have a larger interaction strength, and the constraints on N effective weaken a little bit, not a lot. But that's the point of this exercise is to study the shifts in these parameters when you look for something that, when you allow something to have some interactions. And it's always weaker when you have some interactions. Not a lot weaker if you look at like the 1D posterior, but if you look at the degeneracy between amount of stuff and interaction strength, you see that trend.
But it's not that something for sure, right? Because like
no.
The previous story was this island.
No, we don't find any evidence of anything. Nothing is, but you can check. I mean, we have all of this data, and we're going to get a lot more data. And this is a perfectly reasonable thing to check. This measurement of N effective is just not just about neutrinos. It's looking for anything extra, and it's. I think that we should use the full power of the data to check for extra things that would behave differently. That's my message. Yeah.
Great question. So the previous thing without which was in complicated particle physics. So if you just in terms of the probability of race factor, like what is how much is there race factor in evidence for the red island versus
it's in our paper, but I don't remember. It's also lower. It's also disfavored, yeah. In that sense. So one fun thing that my student Merle Sirvanan is working on is how well we can study all of these things with future CMB data. So talk to him. Another thing that is related to people at PI is my postdoc working with me at University of Washington, Zach Weiner, who's coming here next year. We studied how, basically the question is the CMB data can't probe the universe much earlier than about a year old. So you might want to try to probe things at earlier epochs. And in some super cool future where we detect gravitational waves, we can use gravitational waves to probe the interaction history of things. And the reason is the following, that free streaming stuff has a tensor piece of its stress its energy momentum tensor, whereas fluid-like radiation has no tensor-like piece in its energy momentum tensor. And so the free streaming stuff interacts with gravitational waves, whereas the fluid-like stuff does not, because it's all described by scalar perturbations. This is some equation from our paper, but the free streaming stuff sources some extra term over here, which looks kind of like a mass term for the gravitational waves. And the effect that you get turns out to be qualitatively different for gravitational waves that are from inflation and have adiabatic initial conditions compared to causally sourced gravitational waves, which can evolve outside the horizon and therefore have some distinct effect. So I will just quickly show you some plot. So the adding free streaming radiation damps the amplitude of primordial gravitational waves. This is shown for gravitational waves from inflation. And the more free streaming stuff you have, the more they are damped. So this means if you also need to jointly constrain inflation, when you add interactions, you should like redo all your R analysis, but the constraints are going to be pretty weak. I mean, the difference in constraints. This is some analysis which is kind of similar to the other cases, but here showing the fractional change in the gravitational wave energy density. This time on the axis, this is basically K tau again, where, sorry, this is this is K in units of the horizon size at the decoupling or recoupling transition. And you see these different, you know, so when everything is interacting, you have no damping of the gravitational waves. And when something decouples, you get damping of the gravitational waves. And these n's are the power law index of how the scattering rate depends on temperature. So if it decouples quickly, you get a sharper transition for a temperature, scaling with a temperature to a higher power. And if it's weaker, you get a weaker transition. And then over here is kind of the opposite, but for something that recouples. So here's this super futuristic plot where we imagine that we have measurements of the energy density and gravitational waves across many spectra. And these are gravitational waves from inflation on this black dashed line. And this has some features at different scales. There's the modes that are probed by CMB are these very, very, very low frequency ones. So these and all of these other modes have been sub-horizon for a really long time. And the features here are related to changes in G star and changes to the interaction strength. So if I make neutrinos decouple later, then I change the shape of the spectrum in this way. So maybe someday we can detect neutrino decoupling in gravitational waves if we have primordial gravitational waves. You get really wild, qualitatively distinct features for causally produced gravitational waves because they evolve outside the horizon, and this presence of this free streaming piece changes their evolution and makes their amplitude oscillate, and you get weird features that are monotonic in the free streaming fraction.
So the standard model that brings out comes at what frequency is there?
Yeah, I mean, this is 10 to the, I don't remember the number. This is 10 to the 9, 10 to the, it's like 10 to the minus 10 to 11. It's right here.
Hertz.
Yeah, hertz.
It's like 30 to 100 years. Eh? Yeah, but,
nanogram.
No, I mean.
That's an anagram. 10 to the minus 9, right? Yeah, so you're.
10 to the minus 9 is 3 years, right? 3 years. Yes,
sorry.
10 to the minus
8?
No, it's 3 years.
3 times 10 to the minus 8.
It means pi times 10 to the 7 seconds per year.
10 to the minus 9 is 30 years.
30 years, okay.
And this kick using 10 to the minus 10. So, okay, so we have time to.
So,
time and precision.
The younger people will have time.
It's not clear.
I missed it completely.
We're all gonna die, she's saying,
so. Oh, we'll die trying.
Yeah.
All right, let me just say, I there's lots more cool and perhaps even more exciting things related to neutrinos and light relics. And two students here are going to talk at group meeting on Thursday about how interact. Well, I don't know exactly which topic Chiruhas has picked to talk about, but ask him about neutrinos and UV background fluctuations that give scale-dependent halo bias and how that interacts with constraints on primordial non-Gaussianity. And Kayo, who's also here and going to talk, has been doing work on new calculations of massive neutrinos, including improving dramatically the fluid approximation that people have used, and also doing these nice computations of neutrino wakes related, you know, work that has been done at PI as well, but developing a theory to compute neutrino wakes and some signatures there. So these are advertisements for listening to them. Thanks.